Welcome to the New Civil Liberties Alliance. I appreciate your joining us for the luncheon law today, which we have moved to happy hour for good and sufficient reasons. And today's topic is how chilling Brewer's free speech puts the First Amendment on ice. We're pleased to have Alan Gura and Justin Cox with us, and today's panel will be moderated by NCLA's Senior Litigation Counsel, Mike DeGrandis. And Mike, I will turn it over to you for introductions of our guests.
Very good.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Mark. As Mark said, we're here with Alan Gura and Justin Cox. Alan is on my far right over here. Alan is a renowned constitutional lawyer with a lot of experience in First Amendment litigation in particular. We'll be leaning on him for that expertise over the course of the next hour. And to my immediate right is Justin Cox. Justin is the CEO of Atlas Brewworks in D.C., and we have some of his beer brought here with us, and we will be enjoying that through the course of this. This is a Blood Orange Goza. I said it correct this time. Goza that I've got here. There'll be some people who will be listening to this online after we're done. They unfortunately couldn't be here with us today, so this is a perfect time for those people, if you're listening, to press pause, run out and get your Blood Orange Goza, come back, press play on your Google machine, and listen to the rest of this with us while you enjoy an Atlas beer. I should also say at this time, too, a little bit of a disclaimer. The opinions by your moderator are his own. They are not to be imputed to either Mr. Gura or Mr. Cox. They are, of course, free to jump in at any time. And who knows, maybe we will debate some issues while we're here. I just want to start off with a very quick history, just to cover 15 years in about 15 seconds. We have, in 1920, the 18th Amendment, Prohibition. Really the only appropriate time during this program where to boo. So 18th Amendment, Prohibition, boo. But the good news is we have the 21st Amendment a few years later in 1933, which repeals Prohibition. That leads us to the end of this little 15-year cycle that I want to talk about, and that is the Federal Alcohol Administration Act, the FAA Act. The FAA Act provided an opportunity for the government to do really a few things. It's a detailed act that sought to do a number of things, but I think for our purposes, you need to know that they, first of all, wanted to limit mob influence, because at the time of the end of Prohibition, that's primarily how you got your booze, was through the mob. So they wanted to reduce mob influence or eliminate it completely. They also wanted to give states a lot of authority with respect to regulating beer within the boundaries of the state. So if states didn't want to end Prohibition, they could continue it, and so forth. We also see a lot of consumer protection goals set forth in the FAA Act. And of course, it's also a revenue-generating act. But they're using a lot of this revenue-generating, I think, for the purpose of trying to control consumption of alcohol. And we see a couple of different ways in which the act would go ahead and effectuate these goals. And one way was to establish or to allow the states to establish a three-tier system. And most states have a three-tier system, and the three-tier system is designed to very strictly separate manufacturers from distributors from retailers. And you know, in so separating, they had hoped to protect various elements of the industry, but also to help limit consumption of alcohol. Three-tier system, I have found in my talks with brewers, is one of the most frustrating aspects of the regulatory system, and Justin may have some thoughts about that a little bit later himself. Just recent news about the three-tier system, the Supreme Court of Texas just declined to issue cert on a challenge to Texas's three-tier system on Fifth Amendment grounds. And just to give you a sense of the impact that this strict three-tier system can have, I spoke with a brewer, I think it was in Michigan last year, who he was a master brewer who decided he wanted to start his own brewery. And everything was going swimmingly until his application for a license was rejected, and it was rejected because his fiancée was a bartender. He explained to the commission, look, she's a bartender. She doesn't own a bar. It's not like that. She's not a retailer in that respect. They're like, well, she still is a bartender. She still could push your product. We have a very strict system here. Which he said, she's a part-time bartender. She goes to school during the day for nursing. He ended up hiring an attorney, ends up setting up a special trust, separates finances, and does this whole big thing. And his application got rejected again. What he ended up having to do, well, what she ended up having to do was quit her night job as a bartender in order for him to get his license. And that's the type of dynamic, the type of authority that states have in regulating the alcohol industry, and it can be quite burdensome. And you see some of this play out, too, in a recent New Jersey ABC regulation that came out that restricts craft breweries to just 2 65-inch televisions. If you have more than 2 65-inch televisions, only 2 may show TV programming. The rest can show promotional videos promoting your brewery itself. And there are other strange rules there. You can't have a restaurant. You can't invite food trucks to your parking lot if you're a craft brewery in New Jersey. But you can have menus from restaurants that deliver, and those restaurants can deliver inside your brewery. We won't get into the politics of that, and a lot of that has to do with just economic sensibility, and that's really beyond the scope of our discussion here. Another issue, of course, is franchise laws. These franchise laws are primarily problems because of the exclusivity, the monopoly granted to distributors. That is a common problem for the beer industry, which really gets us to the most important dynamic that the FAA uses to regulate that we want to talk about today with respect to free speech. And that's, of course, is the COLA process, the Certificate of Label Approval. In order to prevent violations of the FAA Act, the FAA Act says, you know, we're going to have an administration. It would end up being the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau today. TTB is its abbreviated. They will administer the requirements with respect to labeling through a certificate of label approval, COLA, that a brewer, vintner, distiller has to apply for prior to sending their alcoholic beverage into interstate commerce or into foreign commerce. Part of what the FAA Act is trying to do is make sure that these labels have mandatory information such as health warnings and also not have information on their labels that's otherwise prohibited. That would be information such as something related to, that would be considered obscenity or indecency. Making health statements, that is, that your beer is somehow a healthy product. Marketing phrases, I like these, such as pre-war strength. They're very specific about these marketing phrases. Pre-war strength, not allowed currently. Full old-time alcoholic strength, currently not allowed. You're not allowed to make disparaging remarks about your competitors. You are also not allowed to be misleading. Even truthful but misleading information is not allowed. I think it was a TTB circular a few years ago that gave it the example. You may not have on your label arsenic-free. So don't advertise that you have arsenic-free beer because that would suggest that everyone else's has arsenic in it. And they said, well, truthful, that would be misleading. So these are examples of what's prohibited, and so what the TTB does is it manages this process, accepts applications, and one of the obvious problems with this, at least it's obvious to me anyway, that is this is a prior restraint on free speech. And to what extent should brewers accept this prior restraint on free speech? And we'll talk about that in more detail momentarily. I should alert everyone to a relatively new event, and that is the notice and request for public comment of the TTB's modernization rule. They're seeking to revamp these regulations related to beer and wine and liquor labeling. We'll talk about it in more detail later on, but I just wanted to put that out there that some of these rules will be changing, and I think the dynamic of the change doesn't really impact what my major premise is, and that all of this is an unconstitutional prior restraint on speech. It's speech licensing. And you know, we've had the Supreme Court already tell us that there is a distinction between a prior restraint and post-restraint, post-publication restraint. They've explained that post-publication consequences to your free speech chills speech. But when it's a prior restraint, it freezes it. And I think it's something we need to keep in mind as we get into the discussion today. And so one of the things I'd like to talk about, Justin, and when we look at your business and how you go about your business, I don't know if you'd like to talk specifically about the Precious One or just generally, but I'm wondering what goes into just deciding to make a new beer? Like, I want to do something new. What does that involve?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's lots of sort of genesis of where beer ideas come from. And, I mean, we are a business, so we're kind of looking at what's in our portfolio and looking what the demands are out in the market and where we have a gap. So that helps drive it. Helps drive decisions what style of beer we're going to brew sometimes. Sometimes beer is the mother of beer, so after too many beers, we get with ideas of new things that we should try. So we kind of start with the concept of what the liquid we want to taste and look like. Then we sort of work our way back in to the recipe development phase of using, you know, choosing our grains and our malts and our yeast and other things that go into the beer to kind of accomplish those flavors that we're going for. In the meantime, kind of simultaneously with all that, we have to come up with our marketing plan for the beer. So there's now over 7,000 brewers in the country. When Atlas opened 6 years ago, there was, I think, 3,800 or so. So there's been quite a dramatic increase in competition out there. And so in order to stand out, you have to, you know, have a wonderful package. You have to have a catchy name. You have to have, obviously great liquid inside the can, and have a plan for all of that to get out to your distributors, so they can translate that to the retail side. So while we're coming up with all of that too, then we have to keep in mind the TTB regulations. So we have to come up with the packaging design, and we have to make sure that our names and any of the text that we put on our cans are not going to run afoul of any of the TTB guidelines. We have to submit the label once we've paid designers to design the label. We have to submit that to the TTB for their approval. We used to build in about 3 weeks or so for that part of the process. Once we have the art done, we send it to TTB, and normally in about 3 weeks or so, if there was no problems with the label, then we would get the cola and we could move on to send that to production to our can producers. With the shutdown, so the Precious One that he mentioned was a beer that we were hoping to release in the earlier this year, and we were going to release the beer both in cans and in kegs. And in kegs, the label on the keg is called a keg collar, and if you've ever seen, it's the little ring that goes around the top of the mouth of the keg. We had the approval for the cola was processed for the can label, but not the keg label when the government shut down. So it was a huge hindrance for us in that we had beer sitting in our tank. We had a plan. All those things I mentioned, we had already, you know, spent a lot of hours and months putting all of that together, coming up with a marketing plan and then the graphics and the beer itself. And then we weren't able to sell it out of state because we couldn't get our label approved by the TTB because they were sequestered during the shutdown. So that really had a cascading effect on a lot of things down the line. Number one, we had a plan with our distributors. We were going to get you the beer at this date, and this is we're going to come talk to your sales team, and then we'll go out and get the beer out. Even little things like scheduling those meetings with distributors is tough. The distributor has, you know, a book of 70 brands or so, and they all want to get in there and do the same thing that we're doing. So trying to hold that commitment of getting in front of their team, that we were lucky enough to have those meetings scheduled. The distributor network of getting them to come and pick up the beer, that's another scheduling issue that we have because they're picking up or receiving deliveries from all of these different brands. So getting our allotted window so we can make sure that we get the beer into their warehouse because they can't sell it unless it's in their warehouse. And then on the production side of things, we had the beer sitting in the tank. We didn't have enough output or enough channel just within DC, so we don't need a cola approval to sell beer just within the district. So the beer was kind of sitting in the tank, and that's taking up space that we could put another beer in, and we could, you know, keep churning beers out. So it was really stifling our kind of throughput production for the entire brewery. I kind of lost where I was going with that.
No, that's great. So from the start of, I got this idea, the precious one, whether you have the name ready or not, right. but this is what I want to do. I think it's an apricot infused. Mm-hmm. Is that right? So I've got this great idea to, I think you're talking about December 2018, when you're like, I don't have a keg collar?
Right. So, yeah, we...
How long was that?
So the kind of conceptual part and the recipe design, sometimes, you know, we can bang that out in a day, you know, okay. If all the stars are aligned. Sometimes it can take months, and, you know, and we'll test recipes out and tweak them and develop them a little bit to get them to the point that we want the beer to be before we put it out. But so that part aside, once we have, you know, the design for the labels, probably takes three weeks or so. Our packaging is somewhat complicated, and there's a lot of detail in it, and we spend a lot of time making sure that the packaging is up to our standards and has all the elements that we like in our packaging. So about 3 weeks for the actual design, about 3 weeks for the TTB approval, and then once we have that approval, if the beer is going into cans, the process of getting cans manufactured, excuse me, there's two types of cans. We have a wrapped can and a painted can. If I get way too in the weeds here, please tell me to stop. But so a can like the Dance of Days can that you have, the blue one, that's a painted can. So it's literally just the can is produced and painted on the can. Sort of an aside is with all the tariffs and the threats of tariffs, the aluminum can market has gone absolutely crazy. And even during the threats of tariffs on imported aluminum, a lot of the big brewers and Coke and Pepsi and all those guys came in and bought up all the capacity for the aluminum factories in the United States. So little guys like us, we actually got dropped by our original can manufacturer because we weren't big enough fish for them to deal with. And then we finally found another one. But anyway, the lead time on the painted cans used to be about, you'd have about 2 weeks for your proof cans, and then once the proof can was approved, you'd have another 6 weeks or so before the cans are delivered. That whole process now is about 6 to 8 months or so. So that's gotten absolutely crazy also. But on the wrapped can, so this is a can that actually just has a shrink wrap on it. So the label's printed separately than the can. They put the label on the can, send it through a heat tube so it shrinks the label on there. The lead time on these cans, once you have the proof again back from, you get the label back from the TTB, you send that to the can manufacturer, they do their own internal proofing, you can sign off on that proof. That process takes about 2 weeks or so, and then the manufacturer of the sleeved cans is about 6 to 8 weeks or so.
And and it's important to note, if I didn't make it clear earlier, that this is an exemplar. You've got to provide the TTB with the exact replica of what you're, whether it's shrink wrap or whether it's painted, whatever Justin decides to put on his beer can, it's got to be exact. He doesn't have flexibility to change it. There are some exceptions. That really does get into the weeds. There are some minor exceptions, and the new rule proposes even more exceptions. We might get to those a little bit later. So, Alan, you've got your client here who's obviously got a very serious problem. The immediate problem is bad enough because he can't put his beer into interstate commerce. And for God's sake, he's in D.C. Virtually everything is interstate commerce. And so there's an immediate crisis, but there's also this potential, as Justin was explaining, we have this through process problem. I mean, what are we going to do to develop new products and get them, you know, in and out the door too? Because you do a lot of seasonal beers. So what was your approach to Justin's problem?
Well, when we look at the beer can, if I may borrow that can for a moment here, Justin, I hope everybody here has a beer can or a beer bottle in front of them. You will notice that there are images and words on these items. The Supreme Court has held ever since the early 1990s that beer labels are speech, right? There's information, there's graphics, it tells you all kinds of things. It communicates not just the fact that there's beer in the can, it tells you the brand name, it gives you the ingredients, it has suggested food pairings, it has various images that try to imbue a feeling, try to communicate a brand. You know, we don't simply consume unmarked liquids in this country or beer that comes in a plain brown paper bag that just says, you know, North Korean, you know, beer. No, it has to, you know, evoke something in the consumer. And so the can, the label on the bottle or the can, is the primary means by which the producer of this product communicates with the consumer. Consumers want this information, right? They go shopping, they want to know, you know, what to buy, and they do judge beer sometimes by its cover. Eventually, they'll judge it by its taste. So the Supreme Court has held this type of communication, this label, is speech. It's protected speech, even if you call it commercial speech, which under our First Amendment doctrine enjoys a somewhat reduced level of protection than, say, perhaps political speech. Nonetheless, it's a significant amount of First Amendment protection. And there have been cases over the years where courts have struck down various attempts to interfere with brewers and other beverage makers' attempts to convey messages through their product. I handled a case a number of years ago for Flying Dog Brewery up the road in Frederick, Maryland, where the state of Michigan banned Flying Dog's Raging Bitch IPA because the liquor commissioners in Michigan were scandalized by this label. They felt that the name of the beer was offensive. It hurt their feelings. They didn't like the image on the beer. They felt that the cartoon dog there was too vulgar. They had a lot of reasons for not liking the image. And so we took them to court and made them understand eventually in a happily expensive way that actually the First Amendment does not allow them to vent their personal moral beliefs about the label and interfere with that form of speech between the brewer and the consumer. So Justin here and Atlas have essentially the same problem that we've seen over the years once in a while, government interference with their ability to put out a label. Whatever else you might say about the cola process, and there are a lot of criticisms that we can make of it, that it gives the TTB perhaps a little bit too much discretion as to deciding whether to approve or disapprove a label. Maybe some of the standards we can argue about, whether they should even be able to prevent you from disparaging a competitor. I mean, what's more American than disparaging a competitor, right? We can fight about that all day long, but the bottom line is that when the shutdown occurred and TTB lost its funding authority to issue the COA licenses at all, what we had was a situation where effectively the government was prohibiting beer labels and other alcoholic beverage labels entirely as a category. We required a new act of Congress to allow people to put labels on their products. Because without an act of Congress, there's no appropriation and there's no license available. And without a license, the Attorney General stands ready to prosecute you for violating the Federal Alcohol Administration Act if you put an alcoholic beverage into interstate commerce. So the problem here in this case was not so much what TTB was doing or not doing. TTB was out of the picture. They were shut down. They didn't exist as a matter of law, almost. The problem here was the Attorney General standing by, threatening, ready to prosecute Atlas or anybody else who would publish an unlicensed label.
It's a criminal offense.
It's a criminal offense. It's correct. It can result in some serious penalties, especially you can have your beer back. Thanks. I don't want to get between Justin and the beer. In any event, so we brought a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court here in D.C., suing not the TTB, but the Attorney General, trying to get injunctive and declaratory relief against this concept that the government can prohibit the publication of beer labels simply by virtue of there not being an appropriation that authorizes the licensing of the speech. That is, you can't simply ban speech because the speech licensing office is closed. And we had a couple of theories for this, neither of which were, I think, too adventurous. The first one is, look, you have a total prohibition on a category of protected speech, that is beer labels. It's a form of commercial speech. What justifies, under the First Amendment, this prohibition? Well, in order to allow a prohibition of commercial speech, the government needs to show that there's some kind of important reason. They have some kind of a regulatory interest that they're trying to advance, that the regulation actually advances that interest in some sort of material way, and that there's no less restrictive alternative to achieving this absolutely necessary result. Well, a couple of problems here. First of all, the shutdown was unintentional. Okay, when the FAA Act was written in 1935, Congress never imagined, never provided for the idea that someday there wouldn't be an appropriation to fund it, right? This isn't like Congress made a conscious choice to shut down beer labels because they thought beer labels were bad for society for some reason. And it's not as though Congress has some kind of a valid, legitimate public interest to stop the drinking of beer. I mean, we resolved that with the 21st Amendment. Rather, it's just happenstance. So there's no actual government policy that's informing this turn of events. Even if there were some kind of governmental interest in prohibiting the publication of new beer labels, You still had to ask, okay, does this materially advance that interest? Is prohibiting the publication of the beer label something that really actually advances whatever this anti-beer interest is? Well, maybe, maybe not. Atlas can still sell its beers domestically in the District of Columbia. Brewers could still sell beers in-state where you don't need a cola to sell a beer, at least not under federal law. And finally, you know, is there a less restrictive alternative? Well, obviously, there must be some way of protecting the public against whatever hypothetical evil there is, short of banning all beer labels. So under the established test for prohibiting commercial speech, I think the government was a sure loser. But there was also a prior restraint issue. As Mike mentioned, this is essentially a prior restraint. There is a requirement under the law that before you speak, you obtain permission from the government to go ahead and speak. And prior restraints are not per se unconstitutional, but they do come before the court bearing a very heavy burden. They are presumptively unconstitutional. And the government has the burden of proving several things before it can impose a prior restraint. First, the licensing system cannot vest what we call unbridled discretion in the licensing official. There have to be objective standards that limit the official's choice in licensing or not licensing the speech. Obviously, when it comes to the COLA, we can have a serious discussion about that. But that's not an issue in this case. The second prong is the one that really sank the government here, and that is there has to be a time limit on the length of time that the decision maker can take to making his or her decision. And here, of course, there was no time limit because there was no act of Congress. We had no idea how long the shutdown would last. It might last 2 days, 3 days, a week, a year. Who knows? But basically, Atlas was told, you cannot speak until you have this license. What's the time limit for issuing the license? Well, between now and forever. And that's not really a valid First Amendment standard under the prior restraint doctrine. So we came in, we sought a temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction. The government responded with, you know, sort of the usual government response where they try to argue not on the merits, but trying to figure out other, you know, reasons why for various technical reasons the case shouldn't be heard. As it turned out, the court was on the verge of issuing a decision on our case when, at really the last moment, the president decided that he would sign the continuing resolution and fund the government for another couple weeks. And so the government came in and said, the money's back, no harm, no foul, the case is moot. Well, not so fast. The immediate injury was mooted out. That is, Atlas was allowed to sell the precious one, the beer that was sitting in the tank could not go out. They were issued the license for that particular cola for the keg collar. But that only resolved that particular incident involving this particular beer. It did not resolve Alice's claim. Because Alice is challenging not just the incident that happened with this particular brand. Alice is challenging the policy of having the Attorney General stand by, ready to prosecute as an essential matter, the publication of uncolaed beverage labels during times when the cola office is shuttered. So that dispute is still outstanding. And even if you could say that the case is moot because the policy dispute somehow doesn't continue, even though it's still a matter of much dispute between the parties, even if the case would otherwise be moot, the courts have an exception to the mootness doctrine for matters that are capable of repetition yet evading review. The court looks to see whether or not this is capable of happening again. Is there a reasonable probability that this same dispute will happen again such that resolving this case will affect the relationship between the parties? And is it going to evade review? That is, how long does it take to resolve this type of legal dispute? Is this something where the case becomes moot, typically, before the courts can finish resolving it, because it does take time to litigate matters? And on these grounds, I think we have a very strong case. First of all, is there a reasonable probability that there will be another government shutdown? It will never happen again. Never, right? Well, in the modern budget era, which started in 1977 when Congress created the current budgetary system, we've only had four times where Congress has enacted all of its appropriations bills on time. Now, of course, oftentimes they will have a continuing resolution or some other mechanism whereby, you know, they don't finish the appropriations for the agency for the full year, but they have a Band-Aid that keeps the money going and averts a shutdown. But even so, on average, every 2 years, we've had a lapse of appropriation. And they've gotten worse. We went through a long period. I mean, it's not consistent. We had one long period where there was nothing, and then we had a whole bunch of them in a row. And the severity has gotten worse and worse. But if you look back towards 1977, it's happened 21 times. So about every 2 years, there's a failure of appropriation that causes the government to shut down at some point in time. And you might ask yourself, well, have courts looked at shutdowns, and what have they decided? And the answer is yes, they have, and courts have split. We have mostly unpublished decisions, at least locally, and in a lot of other places, where courts have bought the argument that it will never happen again. And every time it happens, they say it will never happen again. And, you know, it's kind of a joke. But not always. There have been cases where courts have said, no, it's happened enough times. We will now proceed to evaluating the constitutional claims. And there are a number of cases on point that have said that. So we do have a split in the way the courts have approached it. But I think that with each succeeding shutdown, each successive lapse of appropriations, it becomes more and more ridiculous to say it'll never happen again. Obviously, this is just a feature of a constitutional system. For better or worse, this happens. And it's better, I think, for us to decide what to do about our constitutional rights now, when we don't have, perhaps, a looming, pressing issue, but we can resolve it in a way where if the government loses, they have some time to think about how they want to address this. Do they want to make a permanent appropriation or a multi-year appropriation? Do they want to change the policy? Do they want to consider Americans' First Amendment speech rights to be essential functions for the government to protect, like the collection of taxes that TTB continues to do even when the government shut down? So, I mean, we can resolve these things.
Would the government like to just stop regulating people's speech?
That's right. No,
that's not a bad idea.
Yes, you they will collect the excise tax on the alcohol, but you can't. It's not essential to keep publishing. So anyway, will it happen again? I think so. And then will it evade review? Well, at least in the D.C. Circuit, for those of you here in River City, you should be aware that the D.C. Circuit holds that any agency action that happens that typically happens and is complete within 2 years is one that's going to be evading review, because evading review means for the courts evading Supreme Court review, not evading a TRO at the district court. You need to give litigants time to take their case before the Supreme Court. If the agency's on-off switch, flips on, flips off, in a time period that's under 2 years, the courts will say, that's evading review, we're going to go ahead and resolve it. So where are we now? The government has moved to dismiss the case. Our brief opposing that motion to dismiss is due in just a few days. You can log on sometime on or about June 10th and download our opposition and see where we are. They get a reply sometime in July, and I suppose that sometime the court will decide it. I hope that the court reaches the merits. If the case is held to be moot, notwithstanding the capable repetition and evading review doctrine, well, number one, we're going to appeal it, but also you can rest assured it'll happen again, and we'll just, you know, there will be another lawsuit. Of that, you can be assured.
Absolutely fascinating. Such an interesting approach, I think, you've got to this, and an interesting argument regarding free speech. I mean, how can the government stand there and justify the ongoing restrictions that it otherwise suggests? It has such an important interest in regulating, and then just not be there and not let Justin go ahead and put his beer into interstate commerce. Just a couple other thoughts related to that, but before I get to those, Justin, just... I've found it interesting talking to brewers across this country. They seem to have some real mixed feelings about cola regulations. I'm wondering if you could just share yours with us. Just are there things you like about it, dislike about it? If it went away tomorrow, just from a business perspective, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Do you have thoughts?
I have lots of thoughts. I mean, at one side of me, it likes the colas just from the mere fact that once you have the cola, then it's sort of a backstop in your back pocket. Then you say, okay, you know, I'm not going to get in trouble for anything that's on this label. You know, I've got my little stamp here, and that means that everything's okay. On the other side, I find the process really clunky, and I get in lots of back and forth with the TTB on different things on the labels. Like, even when we first opened Atlas, our original keg collar said Atlas Brew Works, District of Columbia, and they kicked that back and said that the address didn't match my brewer's license, which says Washington, D.C. on it. And there's, like, that's an absolutely ridiculous thing. And there's lots of little things like that that we go back and forth with them about. There's all kinds of, you know, if you have a Belgian pale ale, depending on who's reviewing it, sometimes Belgian pale ale is okay, and sometimes you have to say Belgian style pale ale. Little things like that are frustrating. We've sort of built into our process that that's part of it. And so, you know, as I was talking about our timelines, we've just sort of built in time that we're being unproductive otherwise while we're waiting on this or going back and forth with the TTB.
And that's interesting because it leads into one of the comments I wanted to make just with respect to what Alan is talking about here. You know, we talked about that this is content-based restriction, and that's important just because of the burden the government bears in demonstrating that this content-based restriction on speech it should be upheld by any court on challenge based upon the government's interest and also the narrowness and focus of the government's choice in how it's restricting speech. But you can see the real fundamental problem here is the over-inclusiveness of it all. And so while Justin here will submit his blood orange label to the TTB. Was this kicked back to you at all?
It was, in fact.
It was. Okay.
We had on the side of the can, we have sort of an icon that goes along with all of our beers. We have a little story about the icon. And I don't know if you knew this yet, but originally it said something about how it'll quench your thirst as the sun sets on a hot summer day. And we're not allowed to say the beer is going to quench your thirst because that is we're making a health claim on the.
Oh, excellent, excellent. I didn't even know that. That's awesome. That is absolutely perfect. So for all of the information that's provided here on Justin's can, most of it was completely innocent, perfectly acceptable speech to the TTB. So just to my over-inclusiveness point. So it's getting in a lot of speech that is totally bad. This is the problem with a prior restraint. And it finds this one itty-bitty problem that it's claiming is health-related. There's another great health-related story, and there are a couple years separating these two, but a beer label was rejected for having the King of Hearts on it because TTB at the time said, that's a health-related claim. You're suggesting that. And the argument back was, no, that's not at all what we're suggesting, but the TTB said, yes, but you might be giving that impression to someone because you're not smart enough to figure out that a King of Hearts playing card. But just a few years later, on a bottle of wine, a Queen of Hearts playing card was A-okay. And that gets us to the unbridled discretion problem. You know, now you're looking at real unbridled discretion, where, as a matter of fact, there was I just read recently, Hoppy was one, where someone had tried to submit intensely hoppy, and that was rejected. So they came back with... I think exceedingly hoppy was rejected, but when they came back with intensely hoppy, that was accepted. And it was related to health, was the claim. And it's just a peculiar way to run a business. And I wasn't aware, actually, that in talking to brewers, my understanding was that the TTB was getting more and more lenient with those types of restrictions, that they weren't rejecting those. But that's interesting because that was just in 2018, right?
Probably, early 2018.
Interesting. So one of the other problems that the current regime has is that their suggestion to change it, so I mentioned the modernization rule that's coming up, doesn't really change the underlying fact of a prior restraint on speech. They are doing some things that are liberalizing. So one of the things that you can't put on your beer can currently, the American flag, and that's because the TTB is afraid that if you have the American flag or the Marine Corps emblem or something along those lines that you could confuse the American public into thinking that the United States of America has certified this beer in one way or another, either has inspected it at the manufacturer point or that you think it's somehow affiliated with the United States. TTB is now saying in this proposed rule, you know what, you can now use the American flag. But, and you'll see where they haven't really changed the underlying problem, but we're still free to reject the American flag on your label if you're creating a misleading impression that it's somehow sanctioned by the United States of America. So they're going to still review the content. They're still going to determine, without any set standards, because it's just their impression, you know, what would cause a consumer to somehow think that this beer is a beer of the USA or something along those lines. And obviously, you know, we don't really need to get into the decency standard. I mean, there, the TTB has, without changing rules, very much liberalized its standards as a beer within the last couple years. I will censor myself here. Was submitted for and accepted, FR Let's Dance, and that is the beer label that was accepted. The TTB seemed to have no problem with that with respect to decency or obscenity. So it's difficult to know what the standards are, and it shouldn't be difficult to know. Well, they also shouldn't be in this business in the first place.
Just quickly in our case with the with Alan and the Precious one too. There was nothing on the label that would have been rejected if the government was open. It would have been processed, although I think that's important to point out that the government had no problem with the content on the label, even though they could have, but everything was acceptable. But.
Alan, I'm wondering what you think about if you care to comment on this, the regulatory regime in the sense that there are different requirements when we talk about prior restraint, post-restraint, for lack of a better phrase, for labeling versus advertising. I find it fundamentally inconsistent that the TTB would interpret the FAA Act as saying, on the one hand, the only real way to ensure that brewers like Justin abide by the law is to check what they're doing at the outset. But when it comes to advertising, we're advertising. I mean, I'm reaching far more people, even people who aren't actively shopping for alcohol. There, it's a post-restraint. You know, you have to understand that if you abuse your right to free speech, there are consequences. Do you see a dichotomy there like I see it?
Well, there's a dichotomy. There's also a danger if you keep pressing that argument, the government will say, great, now we need to make advertising subject to prior restraint. You know, submit all your ads for review to the TTB instead. So, but it's, yes, I mean, typically speech is regulated after the fact in this country. If you say something that you're not supposed to say, if it's illegal in some fashion, you know, you're going to face consequences for it. But prior restraints are, you know, not favored under our laws. And to have a prior restraint for alcohol specifically is kind of interesting. I mean, there's no really reason why alcohol should be treated differently than other consumer products or other things that it could be harmful. You can make harmful claims about all kinds of items that are out there in society, and why this particular product has to be treated in this particular fashion is probably an historical anachronism or the product of some kind of a, you know, societal issue with the fact that it's an intoxicant.
Right, well, and those of you who are having maybe some of the bags of pretzels back there, or if you had water instead, there, you know, no prior restraint on those. You know, they're still you have a responsibility as a producer of pretzels and of water not to have false or misleading information on there. Certainly, you're not allowed to do that. And nobody is checking, you know, to make sure that, you know, you've abided by all the rules ahead of time. Sure. Nobody's preventing you from getting to market. But there will be consequences if you run afoul of the law after the fact.
Sure, you can put a maker of children's sugary cereal can put something on the box that says, you know, eat all you want, kids, you know, this will... It'd be great for you.
And, big,
you know,
and strong.
This big and strong, eat all the, you know, sugar pops that you can. And, of course, we can make the argument this is harmful for their teeth, for childhood obesity and diabetes, all these problems that we're facing in society. But yet cereal makers are not required to submit their boxes for review. We can think of all kinds of products that, could, you know, be treated like this.
Certainly. Let's open it up for questions. We only have a few minutes left. Do we have a microphone to... excellent. We have a question right back there.
I recall in the 1990s there was a label which you could scratch to reveal the upper portion of a young woman. And the consequence is that if you happen to have some of those labels, they're worth about $500 a piece on Amazon, eBay.
Scratched off or unscratched off?
The price definitely goes down if you have scratched it.
Gotcha.
What's striking here is that the default should probably be placing the government having to make the case ex post facto. That is to be, you should be allowed to produce your label until somebody objects. The burden of proof should be moved to the government. Because you're not going to be some crazy guy who's going to do something specifically to offend the population. My question, as an outraged consumer, is when I get the Sunday paper and I open up Safeway advertisement or the CVS advertisement, and I see my lovely Atlas beer at $3 less than I'm paying at the package store. Why? Because I'm living in Maryland. And if I happen to be living in Virginia, I could take advantage of this wonderful discount. But because I'm in Maryland, I'm stuck with some 100-year-old law that has to be screwing your sales. And I'm wondering what is with this Maryland thing? Have you challenged it in any way? Is there a class action suit amongst the brewers to say this is, antiquated nonsense? Is there any hope that in my lifetime I will see this damn thing go away? Can you shed some light on that?
Are you in Montgomery County? So Montgomery County is one of the craziest beer or alcohol distribution jurisdictions in the country, where the county itself is actually the distributor. I don't know much about the pricing of beer, because in our system, when we sell to the distributor itself does the pricing, and we're displaced from that. We can't and don't agree on pricing with pricing to retailers with our distributors. I know in Virginia that Chef Jeff's fame is... has a suit with the state, because in Virginia they have a lot of regulations around advertising, and you're not allowed to advertise happy hours, and you're not allowed to have window signs up with its advertising alcohol. And I know he's in a First Amendment case with the state over that. I don't know.
Actually, I think that was just mooted, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah, they passed a law. I'm with Pacific Legal Foundation. We represented Chef Jeff.
Oh, okay.
So they passed a law that mooted that case, but starting July 1st, it'll be legal to advertise.
Well, the Supreme Court did actually in 44 Liquor Mart, this is a long time ago, held that the advertising of price information for alcohol is a First Amendment act. But I think your problem in Maryland is they have a monopoly at the county level on the distribution, and so they can charge what they want. And perhaps it's time for you as a citizen, a voter in Montgomery County, can band together with your neighbors and try to vote a different result. You can form the beer party or something and advocate. And I'm surprised. I don't know why Marylanders, what do you call yourselves in Montgomery County? Montgomeryans? You guys should do something about it.
There is. The state of Maryland does allow for in-state breweries to self-distribute rather than going through distributors. And so there are some breweries who are in charge of their own pricing and that pricing to retail tier. And I'm sure that I see their beers on shelves at lower price points than ours are.
And there's no sense amongst the brewers that they would like to challenge this ridiculous system. I mean, why can't I buy beer in Whole Foods but not in CVS?
I think that would be a political choice in the end. I mean, I don't know how you would.
It would, and it's something that is important to us, but most of us brewers are small businesses with 90 million things going on, and a larger fight like that with possible, repercussions has just not been taken up.
You can come to Alexandria and buy your beer.
But only so much, because you can only import so much yourself into the
Justin,
account.
I just wondered if you could tell us what happened with the beer that was in the vats at the time that the government was shut down. Were you ever able to distribute it?
Mm-hmm.
We were. So when the government reopened, we magically got our cola, I think, the next day or maybe 2 days later. And then, so the beer, we were able to get the beer out in time. So, I mean, it is a perishable item, and we had, you know, the clock was ticking on that, but luckily the government reopened quick enough for us to get that beer out before it spoiled.
Thank you. I'll admit that I am a member of a home brew club, which when I first started brewing at home...
That's how I got started.
...didn't exist. It was back in the 70s, early 70s. And at that time, the law permitted you to brew beer with no more than 0.5% alcohol. And you couldn't take it out of your home or elsewhere. So things have changed quite a bit, which I'm happy to say, because now we have some of the best beer in this country that you can find anywhere in the world. And I just want to know whether, if I have a second beer, does this constitute under the FAA a flight?
There is some confusion when they've got the same initialization as the airline people. One of the, I also think, interesting points just to throw out here, too, is that just to bring up that the NCLA will be filing comments to the proposed rule. And I would like to just throw out there for your consideration, perhaps, and I don't know what Justin or Alan think of this, but there is one major change that I haven't brought up yet, and that major change would address fundamentally what this prior restraint, this licensing of speech, and that is there will be, once this regulation is in place, an ability to create custom labels. The new requirement for custom labels, and the TTB acknowledges they get tons of requests so that breweries can create labels for weddings and bar mitzvahs and those types of events. It's odd, the rules for these. You submit a cola that has all of your required information, and you just designate where the information will change. And the information that can change includes text, pictures, other types of images. It's not just dates. It's not just names. It's basically any creative expression. And so one of the comments that we'll be making, one of the suggestions we'll be making, is that the TTB should take this new proposed rule for customizable labels and just make that the standard. Instead of an exemplar, just provide them with a template to demonstrate that you've got the minimal information there. And that would fundamentally change, and you're only fundamentally changing one aspect of the market, the beer market. Well, I shouldn't just say beer, wine, and liquor market. It's a big change, but they're only applying it to that exception. I wonder if everyone will just apply for a cola under that exception. I would. I don't know. Yes, you got another question?
Hi. When I lived in Germany and I bought a case of Bitburger beer, it seemed to have a shelf life to it. If I didn't drink it within 3 months, the beer had a sort of stale taste to it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what was on the bottle because it was all in German. But are you required to put a bottled by date on your beer, and is there a shelf life?
We are not required to put any dates on the beer, although we do, because we think that's important information for the consumer to have, as well as our distributors to know how to rotate through product. The flavor you are experiencing is commonly referred to as skunking, or we call it light struck. And so when beer is in a bottle, even if it's a brown bottle, some light will get through that bottle, and light reacts with the hop compounds in the beer and gives it that kind of stale cardboardy taste. And that sort of, there's a lot of factors that go into that. The packaging of being in a bottle is one thing. The state of the beer when it went into the bottle is another. The conditions of the packaging. But beer absolutely does have a shelf life, and it's sort of variable depending on your packaging conditions and how much hops are in the beer. Hops tend to deteriorate pretty quickly compared to non-hoppy beers. But for Atlas, most of our products are around 120 to 180 days.
Mm-hmm. Have any other questions? We'll be around after too. So I think maybe the best way to wind up a beer discussion is probably with a toast. Thank you, Justin and Alan. Thank you, everyone, for arriving here. May your beer be chilled, but not your free speech.